The War Crimes Trials. Before we review the details of the story, it should be pointed out that there are excellent a priori grounds for expecting a frame-up. There is of course the very general argument that political enmity of a magnitude to bring on armed conflict between two states necessarily excludes the impartiality on the part of one of them, which is a necessity for a fair trial and for which there exists no substitute. The judges had pursued political careers in the context of the internal politics of the Allied powers hostile to Germany, and after the trials would, assuming they had not done anything highly improbable at the war crimes trials, return to these careers. They had, in addition, for several years heard only the anti-German viewpoint. In sitting on the military tribunals, they were ad hoc political appointees. Such considerations exclude approximate impartiality. There are, however, much more specific reasons for expecting a frame-up. In order to see this, it is only necessary to consider the easily obtainable facts concerning the various tribunals involved. First, there was the big trial conducted by the International Military Tribunal, IMT, at Nuremberg immediately after the war. This was the trial of the top Nazis Göring, Hess, Ribbentrop and others, which ran from November 1945 to October 1946. The judges and prosecutors were American, British, French, and Russian. As with all military tribunals, there was no jury. There were 3 acquittals, 7 prison sentences, and 11 death sentences. The latter were carried out almost immediately after the trial, except that Göring escaped the noose by swallowing a potassium cyanide capsule just before the hangings. It was never determined where Göring had obtained the poison or how he had managed to hide it for any length of time. A unique sequel to this episode was that the first Nuremberg prison psychiatrist, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, a leader in the treatment of psychiatric disorders with drugs, shortly later published a book on his experiences at Nuremberg, giving Göring and Göring's last act a laudatory treatment, quote, "He stoically endured his long imprisonment that he might force down the Allied tribunal and browbeat the prosecuting lawyers on their own terms. His suicide was a skillful, even brilliant, finishing touch, completing the edifice for Germans to admire in time to come. History may well show that Göring won out at the end, even though condemned by the High Court of the Allied Powers." Unquote. A decade later, Dr. Kelly followed Göring by taking one of several potassium cyanide capsules which he possessed, said to be souvenirs taken off Göring's body. The IMT trial was the only one that received very great attention. It was important in the sense that the Allied powers committed themselves to a specific version of the extermination claim, but there was little evidence presented of any substantial nature relative to Jewish extermination. It was almost entirely testimony and affidavits, not at all difficult for the victorious powers to produce under the circumstance. The only relative merit of the IMT trial, for our purposes, is that the complete transcript and a reasonably complete selection of the documents put into evidence are readily available in numerous libraries, as a 42-volume set with a very complete subject and name index, see references. From 1946 to 1949, a series of 12 superficially less important trials were held by the Americans before what is here called the Nuremberg Military Tribunal, NMT. They are referred to variously according to the case number, the major defendant, or a more descriptive title, see Table 4 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book. Several death sentences resulted from these trials, but the great majority received prison sentences, in many cases rather lengthy ones. However, almost all were free by the early 50s. The only cases among these that will concern us here in any way are Case 1, a trial of medical personnel involved in euthanasia and medical experiments, Case 4, a trial of concentration camp administration, Cases 6 and 10, self-explanatory, IG Farben case and Krupp case, Case 8, dealing with German resettlement policies, Case 9, the Einsatzgruppen were used for rear security in the East, and Case 11, a trial of officials of various ministries. The U.S. government published a 15-volume set of books, referred to here as the NMT set, in which may be found summaries of the cases, along with very limited selections of the documents put into evidence. The volume numbers corresponding to the various cases are listed in the above-mentioned table. On this point, the student encounters a significant difficulty because, as can be seen by consulting Hilberg and Reitlinger, almost all the evidence for the extermination claim was developed at the NMT, not the IMT. That is to say, the important documents, those which, for better or for worse, constitute major source material for writing any history of Nazi Germany, are those of the NG, NI and NO series, and these documents were put into evidence at the NMT trials. Documentary evidence is, especially in view of the irregular legal and political circumstances which prevailed, immeasurably more weighty than testimony, as has been suggested. The relevant documentary evidence generated at the NMT consists of certain kinds of material allegedly supporting the extermination charges, documents dealing with concentration camp administration, with crematory construction, with deportations, with certain Farben and Krupp operations which employed prisoner labor, with general Jewish policies of the German government, etc. There is of course no direct documentary evidence for an extermination program. As Dr. Kubovi of the Center for Jewish Documentation in Tel Aviv admitted in 1960, quote, "There exists no document signed by Hitler, Himmler, or Heydrich speaking of exterminating the Jews, and the word extermination does not appear in the letter from Goering to Heydrich concerning the final solution of the Jewish question," unquote. The difficulty for the normally circumstanced person is that only small fractions of the NMT testimonies and documents are widely accessible in English translations, in the 15-volume NMT set. Additionally, these translations cannot always be trusted, as will be seen. Also, the extracts which are published have been selected by unknown criteria. Finally, the 15-volume NMT set is likely to be found only in cities of moderately large size. The situation is better if one lives in a very large city, since reasonably complete collections of documents together with the mimeograph trial transcripts, almost always in German, exist in certain library centers. However, the normally circumstanced person may encounter trouble in arranging to examine specific pieces, which he may call for, and in some cases general browsing even by university faculty is not welcome. In addition, no subject or name indexes exist for the NMT trials. Indexes of testimonies of witnesses, with many errors, appear in the NMT volumes. The IMT and NMT trials are almost the only ones of significance here. Of general significance are a series held by the British. Of these, only the Belsen case and the Cyclone B case interests us to any extent. The Poles, Russians, French, Dutch, and Italians have all held trials of no significance except to the victims. The Bonn government has held some trials of slight interest, for example the Auschwitz trial of 1963-1965, reported on by Langbein, by Ladernser, and by Naumann. The manner in which the IMT and the NMT were constituted can be set forth with sufficient completeness for our purposes. Since the autumn of 1943, there had been in existence a United Nations War Crimes Commission, headquartered in London. However, the commission never really did anything except realize at one point that if anything was to be done, it would be done by the individual Allied governments. The first serious move started in the United States. In August 1944, the Joint Chiefs of Staff considered a proposed program for dealing with war crimes. The proposal had been approved by the Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Army. On October 1, 1944, the Joint Chiefs approved this proposal and, at about the same time and in accordance with directives of the Secretary of War, a War Crimes Branch was established in the Department of the Judge Advocate General. The War Crimes Branch, headed by Brigadier General John M. Weir, with Colonel Melvin Purvis as his assistant, was responsible for handling all war crimes matters for the State, War, and Navy departments. The proposal that had been approved by the Joint Chiefs did not survive for very long, for its character had been rather traditional, in that it contemplated, basically, the trial of persons who had broken the accepted laws of war in the field. Thus, offenses committed before the war or acts by enemy authorities against their own nationals were not considered to be under Allied jurisdiction. Thus, for example, all measures against German Jews were considered outside the jurisdiction of the planned war crimes trials. The concept of war crimes was, at this point, strongly under the influence of the principle, never questioned, that a belligerent may try enemy soldiers for the same sorts of offenses for which he may try his own soldiers. The Secretary of War, Stimson, had a conference with President Roosevelt on November 21, 1944, at which Roosevelt made it clear that he had in mind a much broader idea of war crimes, and that the proposals approved by the Joint Chiefs were completely unsatisfactory. Accordingly, in January 1945, Roosevelt designated Judge Samuel Rosenman as his personal representative in discussions on war crimes problems. A meeting of January 18, among Stimson, Rosenman, Attorney General Francis Biddle and others, resulted in general agreement on very much expanded conceptions of war crimes to be tried. Biddle was later to sit as a judge at the IMT, although, for Roosevelt's use at the Yalta Conference, he had written in January 1945 that, quote, "the chief German leaders are well known, and the proof of their guilt will not offer great difficulties," unquote. The Russian IMT quote-unquote Justice Nikitchenko was slightly more direct in declaring before the trial that, quote, "we are dealing here with the chief war criminals who have already been convicted," unquote. In early May 1945, President Truman approved the revised proposals and appointed Robert H. Jackson, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, to act as chief of counsel for the U.S. in the forthcoming trial, and also to represent the U.S. in negotiations with foreign governments relative to constituting the trial. On June 6, 1945, Jackson made an interim report to the president, and later in June, Jackson and his staff set up headquarters in London, where much of the preliminary work for the IMT was done. A key member of Jackson's London staff was Colonel Murray C. Bernays, who was one of the first people who had been involved in war crimes problems. Graduated from Harvard in 1915, he established a law practice in New York. He was given a commission in the Army in 1942, and in October 1943, he was made Chief of the Special Projects Branch, Personnel Division, Army General Staff. His major project in this position was the preparation of plans for trials of German quote-unquote war criminals. After each stage of negotiations with the White House and others, he made the appropriate revisions in the plans being considered, although he was the author of the plan that was eventually settled on, if one is to credit his account. In any case, shortly after the appointment of Jackson, Bernays was awarded the Legion of Merit, the citation reading in part, quote, "Early recognizing the need for a sound basis in dealing with the problem of war criminals and war crimes, he formulated the basic concept of such a policy, and initiated timely and appropriate action which assured its adoption as the foundation of national policy," unquote. Bernays returned to the U.S. in November 1945 and immediately resigned from the Army. Because, as we have seen, there was considerable dialogue at higher levels relating to plans for war crimes trials, it is doubtful that one can take Bernays's claims at full value, but he no doubt had a great deal to do with the drafting of the plans for the trials. Moreover, he had certainly been an appropriate choice for something as novel as the formulation of the quote-unquote legal structure for the war crimes trials, since his views of justice were equally novel. After his return to the U.S., he had a chat with some editors, who characterized him as, quote, "the man behind the gavel," unquote, and in answer to their queries as to, quote, "how the small fry are going to be hooked," unquote, he replied, quote, "there are a good many Nazi criminals who will get off, if the roundups aren't conducted efficiently. But if we establish that the SS, for example, was a criminal organization, and that membership in it is evidence per se of criminality, the Allies are going to get hold of a great many more criminals in one swoop. You know, a lot of people here at home don't realize that we are now the government of Germany in our zone, and that no judicial system can exist other than one we approve. We are the law. If we wanted to, for instance, we could try Germans for crimes 20, 30, 40 years old. We'll be too busy with the current crop of war criminals, though, to have much time to look into ancient wrongdoings," unquote. In London, Jackson negotiated with the Allies on the trials, and his interim report of June 6 became the basis for the London Agreement of August 8, signed by the US, Britain, Russia, and France. An indictment was filed against 24 individuals and 6 organizations, the SS, the General Staff, etc., on October 18, and the trial opened at Nuremberg on November 20, 1945. 3 of the listed defendants did not stand trial. Martin Bormann was never found, Robert Ley committed suicide before the trial, and Gustav Krupp was too ill and too old to stand trial. An attempt was made by the prosecution to substitute Krupp's son as defendant, but this was too much even for that court, so the trial of Alfred Krupp had to wait until the NMT. In passing, we should note that Justice Jackson, in addition to being the American chief prosecutor at the trial, was also in a formal sense the leading personality in the London negotiations relative to the formulation of the legal system, under which he was to operate at the trial. A rare opportunity for a prosecutor, and probably an utterly unprecedented one in respect to proceedings that civilized people have seriously considered to be trials. Equally unique features of the final charter of the IMT were that its jurisdiction was not restricted to acts taken in connection with the war, but extended over the entire life of the Nazi Party, that the defense of superior orders was inapplicable, and that defendants could be compelled by the prosecution to testify. The war crimes branch that had been set up in 1944 did not cease to operate, because in connection with the IMT trial Jackson had, quote, "enlisted the cooperation and participation of the war crimes branch of the Judge Advocate General's Department," unquote. Moreover, in the early months of the IMT trial, and perhaps also later, the ordinary prosecution staff, exclusive of Jackson, was, quote, "on the payroll of the Judge Advocate General," unquote. A significant role for the Judge Advocate General's Department, JAG, was most natural under the circumstances because the JAG was the legal agency of the Army, and the basic American administrative machinery in Germany immediately after the war was that of the U.S. Army. The traditional role of the JAG had been the administration of military justice, courts-martial and related matters. However, during World War II, the operations of the JAG had spread to all phases of military activity where legal matters arose. It even got involved in litigations relative to war production contracts. The Judge Advocate General, Major General Myron C. Kramer, had given a speech in May 1945, in which he declared that the pursuit and arraignment of Nazis was to tax to the utmost the capacity of the War Crimes Branch and become a major activity of the JAG, whose resources he pledged to Jackson. While it is not specified exactly what the War Crimes Branch did in connection with the IMT, it is most likely that it effectively supervised the American, hence major, role in the screening and selection of prosecution and defense lawyers and staff, in the selection of other staff such as translators, and in interrogations. Of course, Jackson formally held much of this authority, but it is reasonably sure that such responsibilities were, in fact, exercised by the War Crimes Branch. The involvement of the War Crimes Branch in trials was, however, much deeper. While the IMT and NMT trials were being conducted, several lesser trials were taking place. Among these were the trials held at the Dachau camp, outside Munich and thus not far from Nuremberg, of the staffs of some concentration camps, Buchenwald, Flossenbürg, Dachau, that had been captured by the Americans, and of those accused of killing 83 American prisoners at Malmedy during the Battle of the Bulge. These trials were supervised by the War Crimes Branch. They were perhaps the most shameful episodes in U.S. history. The entire repertoire of third-degree methods was enacted at Dachau, beatings and brutal kicking, to the point of ruining testicles in 137 cases, knocking out teeth, starvation, solitary confinement, torture with burning splinters, and impersonation of priests in order to encourage prisoners to quote-unquote confess. Low-rank prisoners were assured that convictions were being sought only against higher-ranking officers, and that they had absolutely nothing to lose by cooperating and making the desired statements. Such quote-unquote evidence was then used against them when they joined their superiors in the dock. The latter, on the other hand, had been told that by quote-unquote confessing, they had taken all responsibility onto themselves, thereby shielding their men from trial. A favorite stratagem, when a prisoner refused to cooperate, was to arrange a mock trial. The prisoner was led into a room in which civilian investigators, dressed in U.S. Army uniforms, were seated around a black table with a crucifix in the center, with two candles providing the only light. This quote-unquote court then proceeded to hold a sham trial, at the conclusion of which a sham death sentence was passed. The quote-unquote condemned prisoner was later promised that, if he cooperated with the prosecutors in giving evidence, he would be reprieved. Sometimes interrogators threatened to turn prisoners over to the Russians. In many cases, the prisoner's family was threatened with loss of ration cards or other hardships if cooperation was not obtained. As distinct from the mock trials, the official trials were also an apparently deliberate mockery of any conception of due process. The mockery started with the quote-unquote indictment, which made only general reference to very broad categories of crimes allegedly committed in the years from 1942 to 1945, in the cases of concentration camp personnel, and then proceeded to present a long list of defendants accused of being criminal in the extremely general sense stated. Specific crimes by specific people on specific dates were not part of the indictments, for example document 3590 PS. In some cases, the quote-unquote defense counsel was an American with no legal training who could not speak German. Competent interpreters were not provided at the trial. The quote-unquote prosecution also lacked legal training, as did the quote-unquote court, which consisted of 10 U.S. Army officers. There was one person with legal training present, all of whose rulings on the admissibility of evidence were final. There were 1,416 convictions out of 1,672 tried, with 420 death sentences. While the prosecution could hunt all over Europe for witnesses and, if necessary, torture or otherwise coerce Germans in order to get quote-unquote evidence, the accused, cut off from the outside world and without funds, were rarely able to summon anybody to their defense. In addition, the Association of Persons Persecuted by the Nazis, by a propaganda campaign, forbade former concentration camp inmates to testify for the defense. The American lawyer George A. McDonough, who had had the rather peculiar experience of having served as both a prosecutor and defense counsel in the war crimes program, and later on as a member of a reviewing board and an arbiter on clemency petitions, wrote to the New York Times in 1948 complaining about the lack of legal basis for the trials and remarking that, quote, in 9 problems out of 10, the authorities and the textbooks had no answer, unquote, to the legal questions that regularly and consistently came up, for anybody seriously concerned with matters of legality. For McDonough, the major problem was whether or not a defense of superior order should be accepted in war crimes trials. He wrote, quote, at the Dachau trials, the claim of the accused that he would have been shot himself if he had not obeyed his superior's order to commit an act which he, in ignorance, may have believed to be a legal order, or knew to be illegal, seemed to be handled by the courts as an issue of fact. The availability of this defense seemed to depend upon the age and the rank of the accused, and the state of battle existing at the time of the offense. Again, it would seem high-handed procedure to hold an enlisted man to the knowledge of the illegality of a particular act, when the international authorities themselves are in disagreement as to its illegality, or have never defined the act at all. Hearsay evidence was admitted indiscriminately, and sworn statements of the witnesses were admissible, regardless of whether anybody knew the person who made the statement, or the individual who took the statement. If a prosecutor considered a statement of a witness to be more damaging than the witness' oral testimony in court, he would advise the witness to go back to his home, submit the statement as evidence, and any objection by defense counsel would be promptly overruled, unquote. One notable incident occurred when investigator Joseph Kirschbaum brought a certain Einstein into court to testify that the accused Menzel had murdered Einstein's brother. When the accused was able to point out that the brother was alive and well and, in fact, sitting in court, Kirschbaum was deeply embarrassed, and scolded poor Einstein, quote, "How can we bring this pig to the gallows, if you are so stupid to bring your brother into court?" Unquote. The U.S. Army authorities in charge admitted some of these things. When the chief of the Dachau War Crimes Branch, Colonel A.H. Rosenfeld, quit his post in 1948, he was asked by newspapermen if there was any truth to the stories about the mock trials, at which sham death sentences had been passed. He replied, quote, "Yes, of course. We couldn't have made those birds talk otherwise. It was a trick, and it worked like a charm," unquote. The Malmedy defendants had had a competent defense attorney, Lieutenant Colonel Willis M. Everett Jr. It was Everett's repeated appeals to, among others, the U.S. Supreme Court, plus a chorus of protests from German clergymen and others, plus such details regarding what was going on, that managed to get into the press by various routes, that persuaded the American military governor, General Lucius D. Clay, to request an investigation of the trials at Dachau. On July 29, 1948, the Secretary of the Army appointed a commission consisting of two American judges, Gordon Simpson of Texas and Edward Van Roden of Pennsylvania, both JAG Reserve colonels. They were assisted by JAG Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lawrence, Jr. The commission submitted its report to the Secretary of the Army in October 1948, and selected portions were made public in January 1949. Subsequent public remarks by Van Roden and also, to some extent, by Simpson, plus an independent investigation by a review board appointed by Clay, decisively exposed the whole affair to the point where the defenders of the trials could only haggle about the numbers of German prisoners subjected to brutalities. The review board confirmed all that Van Roden claimed, taking exception only in respect to the frequencies of the brutalities. Oddly, in his book, Decision in Germany, Clay denies the brutalities, but he is contradicted by his own review board. The cases, especially the Malmedy case, attracted a good deal of attention through 1949, and a subcommittee headed by Senator Baldwin conducted an investigation. One witness, formerly a court reporter at the Dachau trials, testified that he was so repelled by what had gone on there that he quit the job. He said that the most brutal had been Lieutenant Pearl, Frank Steiner, and Harry W. Thon. He explained that both Pearl and his wife had been in Nazi concentration camps, and that the Nazis had killed Steiner's mother. Judge Gordon Simpson, unlike Van Roden, trying to put the best interpretation, even if very strained, on the sorry facts that had come out, conceded that this was probably, quote, a poor team, unquote, and explained that the shortage of German-speaking American lawyers and interpreters had forced the army to, quote, draw on some of the German refugees, unquote. Steiner, Kirschbaum, and Thon, later chief of the evaluation section of the Civil Administration Division of the U.S. military government, appeared later and denied all, but they were shaken by the testimony of investigator Bruno Jacob, who admitted a few things. Speaking for the press, investigators Dwight Fanton and Morris Elowitz also denied all. Colonel Rosenfeld denied almost all. He charged that Lieutenant Colonel Harold D. McGown, commander of the American soldiers massacred at Malmedy, had fraternized with SS Colonel Joachim Piper, the German commander, and this explained why McGown had appeared at Dachau as a defense witness for Piper, and had testified that Piper had held talks with him, and had been responsible for saving a number of Americans. As evidence for the fraternization, Rosenfeld claimed that McGown and Piper had been, quote, entirely too friendly during those nights they spent talking together, unquote, and that, when Piper and his men were later able to escape a U.S. Army trap, McGown was with them. Of course, McGown was Piper's prisoner. It will, of course, be argued that these nightmarish Dachau quote-unquote trials have little to do with our subject, because the standard maintained in the trials at Nuremberg were not comparable, and because the bearers of the extermination legend do not cite any of the quote-unquote evidence produced at these trials. There is partial truth to these contentions. Brutality and coercion were not nearly as extensive at the prominent Nuremberg trials as they were at the Dachau trials, and mass exterminations were not emphasized in the Dachau trials, although gas chambers made occasional appearances in testimony. However, the Dachau trials cannot be waved aside so easily, because the administering agency, the War Crimes Branch, was also deeply involved in the Nuremberg trials, as we have noted, and as we are to reconfirm shortly in a particularly striking respect. In addition, coercion was, in fact, employed in order to get evidence at the Nuremberg trials, but that subject is discussed in chapters 5 and 6. None of the four powers was happy with the IMT arrangement, and after the big trial, they split up and held the kinds of trials they were interested in. The British trials reflected a general interest, but on points of relatively minor significance here. The only major French trial was of Tsar industrial magnate Hermann Rochling, whom the French had also tried, in absentia, after World War I. Planning for the American NMT trials had actually started in 1945, and in March 1946, a division of Jackson's office, headed by Telford Taylor, had been created for this purpose. It is worth noting that in all of these trials of Nazis, from the IMT through the Eichmann trial of 1961, in which defense witnesses were not permitted, to the Auschwitz trial of 1963-1965, which the Bonn government would not allow Rassinier to attend as observer, the defense lawyers had no staff of trained research assistants to go through the documents and, in addition, almost all of the documents which were available to them, were controlled by the prosecuting powers. Whatever the legalistic evaluation of such a situation, it can produce a very distorted historical picture, if not approached skeptically. Under the legalistic schema of the occupation, there was an important constraint on the NMT and other single-nation tribunals, quote, "The determination of the International Military Tribunal in the judgments that invasions, aggressive acts, aggressive wars, crimes, atrocities or inhumane acts were planned or occurred, shall be binding on the tribunals established hereunder, and shall not be questioned, except insofar as the participation therein, or knowledge thereof by any particular person may be concerned. Statements of the International Military Tribunal in the judgment constitute proof of the fact stated, in the absence of substantial new evidence to the contrary," unquote. Two administratively distinct organizations functioned at the NMT. One was the collection of military tribunals, the judges, functioning administratively through a secretariat, headed by a secretary general. The judges were recruited in the U.S., quote, by the Department of the Army, unquote. There were three or more judges at any one trial. The second organization was the Office Chief of Counsel for War Crimes, Telford Taylor, which had come into existence on October 24, 1946, immediately after Ribbentrop and the others had been killed. It filed its first indictment the next day. Although there was a trivial difference in their titles, Taylor, who had been an associate trial counsel at the IMT, was really the successor to Jackson in the trials being staged in the Nuremberg courthouse. We will have much to say of the NMT trials in this volume. However, the reader can grasp much of the spirit of these proceedings even from remarks made by some of the American judges who had been recruited by the U.S. Army to serve at Nuremberg. Understandably, these people were normally very reluctant to speak out publicly against what they observed. Thus, the remark of one of the judges in the Fairbairn trial, that there were, quote, too many Jews on the prosecution, unquote, was a privately expressed hint to the prosecution, certainly not intended for publication. However, the presiding judge in Case 7, Trial of German Generals for Alleged Wholesale Murder of Hostages, Charles F. Wennerstrom, spoke out publicly and forcefully immediately after sentences had been pronounced, quote, "If I had known 7 months ago what I know today, I would never have come here. Obviously, the victor in any war is not the best judge of the war crime guilt. Try as you will, it is impossible to convey to the defense, their counsel, and their people that the court is trying to represent all mankind rather than the country which appointed its members. What I have said of the nationalist character of the tribunals applies to the prosecution. The high ideal announced as the motives for creating these tribunals has not been evident. The prosecution has failed to maintain objectivity aloof from vindictiveness, aloof from personal ambitions for convictions. It has failed to strive to lay down precedents which might help the world to avoid future wars. The entire atmosphere here is unwholesome. Linguists were needed. The Americans are notably poor linguists. Lawyers, clerks, interpreters and researchers were employed who became Americans only in recent years, whose backgrounds were embedded in Europe's hatreds and prejudices. The trials were to have convinced the Germans of the guilt of their leaders. They convinced the Germans merely that their leaders lost the war to tough conquerors. Most of the evidence in the trials was documentary, selected from the large tonnage of captured records. The selection was made by the prosecution. The defense had access only to those documents which the prosecution considered material to the case. Our tribunal introduced a rule of procedure that, when the prosecution introduced an excerpt from a document, the entire document should be made available to the defense for presentation as evidence. The prosecution protested vigorously. General Taylor tried out of court to call a meeting of the presiding judges to rescind this order. It was not the attitude of any conscientious officer of the court seeking full justice. Also abhorrent to the American sense of justice is the prosecution's reliance upon self-incriminating statements made by the defendants while prisoners for more than 2.5 years, and repeated interrogation without presence of counsel. 2.5 years of confinement is a form of duress in itself. The lack of appeal leaves me with a feeling that justice has been denied. You should go to Nuremberg. You would see there a palace of justice where 90% of the people are interested in prosecution. The German people should receive more information about the trials, and the German defendants should receive the right to appeal to the United Nations, unquote. Ironically, the validity of Wennerström's attack on the low or non-existent standard of integrity maintained by the Nuremberg prosecution was confirmed even by the nature of Telford Taylor's reaction to Wennerström's statements, which were made in supposed privacy in Nuremberg for publication in the Chicago Tribune. Tribune reporter Hal Faust sent the message to Berlin for transmission to the U.S. on a wireless channel, which was supposedly secure from prying. However, the prosecution, apparently by employment of a ruse, managed to obtain a copy of the message. Ernest C. Dean, Taylor's press officer, immediately phoned Faust in order to attempt, quote, to talk him out of sending the story, unquote. However, the story had already been sent, and Faust replied that, quote, Taylor could not properly have knowledge of the article until its publication, unquote. Taylor thereupon prepared a reply to Wennerström's remarks, and the reply was actually made public before the Tribune published the Faust story containing Wennerström's attack. Taylor accused the judge, among other things, of making remarks, quote, subversive to the interests and policies of the United States, unquote. Wennerström, on arrival in the U.S. shortly after the publication of Taylor's reply and of the Tribune story, stood firm on his remarks and again criticized Taylor. This incident was one of the notable government spying incidents of the year 1948. The Army issued an order against such spying, and there was much speculation that Taylor might be court-martialed. When reporters asked Taylor for his opinion on the legality of his action, the following exchange occurred, quote, I don't know whether it was legal or not, he replied. Weren't you general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission for 2 years before being commissioned in the Army? Yes, but what does that have to do with it? Unquote. Taylor steadfastly refused to express an opinion of the legality of his action but, quote, off the record indicated he was as pleased with himself as a field officer, which he never was, who had just scored against the enemy by a trick outside the rules of warfare as prescribed by the 1907 Geneva Convention, unquote. The quote is from Hal Faust's story about the Taylor press conference. Faust claimed that this was the second instance of Army interference with his messages to his newspaper, and that in the first instance he had been picked up by Army agents for interrogation after his story had been sent.